Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, 12 Days of Christmas special. And Dominic, today it's the 2nd of January.
Yes.
Did anything important happen on the 2nd of January? And if it did, is it perhaps Spanish-themed?
It is Spanish-themed, yes. So it's a huge event in world history, Tom. It's the reconquest of Granada. So you've been to Granada, I assume?
I have, yeah.
The Alhambra?
Several times, yeah.
It's magnificent. Palace, for those people who don't know, on the rock overlooking the city, this great sort of ornament of Islamic Spain. And so what's called the Reconquista has been going on for centuries, effectively, the Christian reconquest of Spain. Now, that in itself is quite a loaded term, and one I think that a lot of historians would be a little bit suspicious of now, don't you? Because, I mean, they would argue that it's not a kind of reconquest so much as the creation of something that hadn't previously existed.
I think it is a reconquest as well.
Do you think it's a reconquest?
It's a reconquest by Christian rulers of lands that had previously been Christian.
I don't really have
a problem with calling
but
it.
But that seems to, you see, what I don't like about that is that seems to imply that the Islamic sort of societies that had been there were intruders, newcomers, whereas they've been there for centuries. I mean, to use the example that I used in yesterday's podcast, they have been there for far longer than the United States has existed.
Yeah, of course, I'm not denying that, but I think that I mean, the Reconquista is obviously a Spanish word coined by the Spanish Christians who themselves, and I think it adequately reflects how they understood the process.
It does, but you don't think it's loaded? You don't think it's very loaded?
Well, I think there's a kind of desire on the part of people to see pre-Reconquista Spain as some multicultural paradise, and I think that was really, really bred of the tensions in the first decade of the 21st century. There was a real desire to say, yeah, there was a time where Muslims and Christians and Jews all got on really well, and they all sat around eating oranges and
bubbling
talking
fountains.
About Aristotle, bubbling fountains, all this kind
philosophy.
Of stuff. Yes, and so the word Reconquista seemed, problematic in that context. But I think that's a fantasy. Islamic rule was incredibly brutal. Christian rule was incredibly brutal. The process was about war. The idea that there was Jews and Christians and Muslims did commune because they all lived cheek by jowl. There was kind of scholarly communication, but in Muslim lands, Christians and Jews were decisively subordinate. And in Christian lands, Jews and Muslims were decisively subordinate. And I think the attempt to imagine that this was some kind of paradise is wholly bogus.
Well, we can get into this.
The language of conquest, I think, is important because it reflects the brute realities of what we're going on.
Okay, we can get into this in more detail in a future podcast. It's great to find a subject on which I can pretend to be more progressive. that is splendid. Let's get back to the anniversary. So the 2nd of January, 1492, the final war, really, in rolling up the Islamic kingdoms of southern Spain has been launched the previous April, and that's the Granada War, the attack on the last emirate, the last Islamic emirate. And it's been launched, obviously, by Ferdinand and Isabella, the most Catholic monarchs, as they are known. So Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, who are going to unite to create Spain. Granada is isolated. It is friendless. Its allies have been defeated or have basically lost their nerve. So for what become the Spanish, it's actually a relatively easy job to kind of surround it and subdue it. The Granadans issue appeals to the Ottomans, to North Africa and so on. But basically everybody ignores them because they know it's a kind of complete lost cause. Then there's a very strange kind of, it's almost like a kind of Brexit deal process. So in November 1491, the attackers agree a kind of pre-truce truce with the defenders. And they sort of say, well, we'll pause while we discuss the details of the truce. And then the final deal is done in time for the 2nd of January. And that's the day that even now in Granada, they celebrate it. They have marches and processions, and they have sort of this great fiesta, because this is the death knell of Muslim Spain, and the moment that a kind of new Spain is born. So the guy who is in charge of Granada, he's about in his early 30s, about 32, and his name is his actual name is Abu Abdallah Muhammad the 12th, but he's known to Spanish chroniclers as Boabdil, sort of corruption of Abdallah. And Boabdil rides out with about 80 of his men on the 2nd of January to the camp on the banks of the River Genil, which is sort of facing the fort, the Alhambra, to Ferdinand of Aragon's camp. And there, in this sort of this great sort of set piece
tableau, isn't it?
Scene, absolutely,
kind of Clash of Civilizations tableau
by so many Spanish painters and so on. He hands over the keys to the city to Ferdinand, basically in surrenders. And the great thing about this tableau, Tom, is that one of the people who is there and watching
is Christopher Columbus,
is a young Italian who's been pestering Ferdinand and Isabella to pay for his plans to go into India. And of course, it's Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
And later on, we have a letter that Christopher Columbus writes to Ferdinand and Isabella when he's sucking up to them. And he says, "I remember seeing the royal banners of your highnesses planted by force of arms on the towers of the Alhambra." So, you know, he's there watching this extraordinary landmark moment, which for a lot of people, I think you could say, is the end. You know, it's one of those end. When do the Middle Ages end?
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of those moments, the end of Islamic Spain, the moment that the balance, you could argue, that the balance between the West and Islam, for want of a better expression, begins to tip. Of course, you've got the high points of the Ottoman Empire to come. But from this point onwards, Spain is unified and created, and Spain is going to, of course, become the great superpower. So there's one more moment, which is the moment...
Is it his mum?
It is his mum.
His mum.
The moment
very,
that everybody remembers.
Stern.
So if you've ever been to Granada, it's surrounded by mountains. The Albujaras, I think they're called. We almost went on holiday up in the mountains, very windy roads. Anyway, so he's winding up into the mountains, into exile, because he's going to go to Morocco, to Fez, and spend the rest of his days in Fez. And the story goes, always told by Spanish kind of folklorists, that he stops at this kind of ridge and he looks back over at the Alhambra, the great pink stone walls in the dying sunlight, the sound of the
fountains. Beautiful buildings in the world.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tremendous. This vision of Alhambra is created to be paradise.
And it is paradise. I mean, it is among the most beautiful buildings.
And he looks back and Boabdil, and he weeps. He sobs. And his mother, his mum, says to him,
I know.
Now you weep like a woman over what you could not defend as a man. I mean, imagine if your mum said that to you, you'd never recover.
No.
Would you? I mean, that would scar you for life. So that's called, his sigh.
It's called the Moor's Last Sigh. So as in Salman Rushdie book.
Salman Rushdie book. And the pass where he supposedly stops, it's called the Pass of the Moor's Sigh.
That's very romantic.
It's a very romantic story, but actually what then happens is pretty unromantic. So you get the sort of the forcible conversion of a lot of the Moors, the Moriscos.
Well, because actually the treaty is pretty generous.
It is.
So there's no forced conversion.
No.
And even Christians who've converted to Islam don't have to convert back.
But the Spanish soon renege on that.
They do,
and they start, there starts to be this series of kind of forced conversions.
So Moriscos,
expulsions,
they come to be
the Moriscos, exactly. Yeah. Confiscation of property and so on. It goes on for ages. So one of the biggest waves of expulsions comes at the beginning of the 17th century. I mean, you're talking about a massive movement of people, refugee kind of crisis. So tens of thousands of people
and
going to North Africa.
And it's not just Muslims, is it? Because,
no.
So there are three kind of seismic events that happen in this year. So the fall of Granada, Columbus's voyage across the Atlantic, and the expulsion of the Jews.
Exactly. So actually the fall of Granada creates this momentum for a unified Christian Spain in which the Muslims and the Jews do not belong. And so you get the expulsion of the Jews, who, of course, you know, tens of thousands of people who end up going to Italy, to Greece, to North Africa. And that's the origin of the kind of Sephardic Jewish branch. And
it's
Jewish
a massive
diaspora.
Exodus.
Yeah, colossal.
I mean, a huge.
Into places
huge,
like, you know, I don't know, Smyrna, Thessaloniki, and so on. Alexandria.
And the Ottomans, of course, they, you know, can't believe that the Spaniards for being so stupid.
Exactly.
Expelling all these, you know, incredibly able and wealthy people. But to us, it's kind of the ultimate crime, isn't it? It seems a crime against a multicultural, harmonious future. But it exists in the context of apocalyptic yearning, I think. I think Ferdinand seriously sees himself as a figure who may be destined to bring in the second coming. He's very, very focused on the recapture of Jerusalem. And Columbus, likewise, is very, very motivated by this kind of idea that, you know, the end of the world is drawing near. And people's motives exist in a context that to us seems very, very hard to get a grasp on, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I read a book a year ago by a guy called Fernando Cervantes. I don't think he's related to these Cervantes.
These Cervantes.
He's a Mexican historian, and it's a book called Conquistadores. And it's a book about what happens in the same year. So basically the arrival of the Spanish in the New World. And a lot of the, you know, obviously a lot of the people who arrive in the New World have been in these campaigns. So they have been fighting against the Moors, and they are absolutely, one of the things that Cervantes really brings out in this book is he says, you know, we traditionally see the Spanish arrival in the New World as motivated purely by plunder and greed and cynicism and all of these kinds of things. And the Christianity is merely a fig leaf for all that. And this obviously would appeal to you, Tom. He says, no, that's not right. The Christianity is not a fig leaf at all. It motivates everything. And you cannot understand them if you think of them as just as butchers and plunderers and robber barons.
Absolutely.
They see themselves as... So when they talk about, you know... For example, when they talk about converting the Muslims in southern Spain, or when they talk about converting the Indians in Mexico and in Central America, this isn't just sort of cruel repression. They genuinely believe that they're saving these guys' souls.
Absolutely. Just as in the Islamic period, the Muslim conquerors impose on Christians and Jews templates of subordination that have been established in the Quran. The cycles of conquest and dominance and exploitation on both the Muslim and the Christian side are absolutely fueled, of course, by everybody wants to be on
rich,
the top,
yeah.
But it is also massively fueled by very, very culturally determined ways of understanding what how that dominance should be expressed. And I think that with the conquistadores, we did that wonderful episode with Camilla Townsend, talking about the Aztecs and Mexica, how they saw the world, and how the effort to understand how they understood things transforms your understanding of the process of the conquest. But I think exactly the same is true of the conquistadores, and that's why I thought that book was so wonderful as well. I thought it's a kind of wonderful companion piece to Camilla Townsend's Fifth Son.
It is, actually. Well, what it does, I think, Tom, is that there's a kind of slightly bad habit, I think, an automatic kind of scholarly habit in the last 50 years or so, to say people believed this, but this was actually merely a pretext, or what they really cared about. And generally it's a kind of, what they really cared about was money. And that's true with almost everything. So people, you know, with culture wars, people people don't really care about culture wars.
I mean, that is a kind of lingering aftershock of Marxism, isn't it?
It is, exactly. That
everything is to be determined, you know, explained ultimately in material terms. But I think it's also, it's a kind of a laying claim to a kind of sophistication that, you know, I've studied history so long that I've now penetrated to the dark motives that fuel how people have behaved.
There's a very petty example of this in the last few years in Britain, which is when people talk about Brexit and they say, well, people who voted for Brexit didn't really do it because they didn't want to leave the EU. They really did it because of racism, anti-austerity, blah, 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 blah. And you know, this sort of, I've penetrated to the deeper motives that these people themselves don't even realise they
have. Yeah, well, also, there's nobody voted for Brexit to make themselves poorer. Well, I think actually quite a lot of people did, because,
well, anyway,
you know, there are things that are more important than that.
Who knew the conversation about the conquest of the Alhambra could lead us to just a rambling conversation about Brexit?
Well, but you know, you will know that this has been the great theme. That's the great theme of Dominion, is that actually it's not just about material self-interest.
No, no, no. You're absolutely right. I agree with you.
That this stuff really, really matters. It's
now,
really
if you think you may have heard some of this from us before, you will be relieved, because in the second half, we are talking about somebody we've never mentioned on the podcast and a part of the world I think we've never mentioned. We will be delving into the murky world of the Hawaiian monarchy. See you after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. I promised you the Hawaiian monarchy, and that's what you're going to get. Tom, this is not a subject I was expecting us to ever talk about on this podcast. No. Enlighten me.
No. Well, I'm going to put my hands up and say that this is not a subject that I really know anything about at all.
Well, that's a good start. Have you researched it closely? Yes.
Well, it's a subject that I became interested in because of a drama series that I watched last year called White Lotus. Did you see it?
Brilliant series. Absolutely.
I thought.
Brilliant
series. I mean, I thought it was the best satire on the way the West is at the moment that I've seen for a long time.
What was nice about, but I think you're almost underselling it, because you can, that makes it sound quite political. And actually one of the great things about it was that the politics was constantly being kind of undercut.
That's why it's a great satire.
Yeah.
I mean, but it was also great character studies. So essentially the plot is, it's set in a hotel, luxury hotel. Appalling rich visitors arrive. There's the staff who are exploited. And of course, the dynamic is that the rich, the white outsiders are exploitative. But it becomes more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant, brilliant series. And lurking, a kind of thread running through it, is the way in which Native Hawaiian culture has been commodified, has been dissipated.
That's right.
Essentially, kind of exists to make money from rich
tourists. Colossal tourist attraction, basically.
Yeah. And I kind of watched it, and there's kind of an incredibly moving sequence where there are Native Hawaiians who are in a long boat, and they're practicing. And one of the most miserable American characters in the series ends up becoming transfixed by this, and it's almost kind of redemptive in its quality. It's one of the few kind of, it's a visual kind of statement of hope, almost, of the sublime. And I watched it and realized I knew nothing at all about Hawaii, apart from the fact that Captain Cook died there. And that was basically the limit of my knowledge. Yeah. So I kind of just basically skim read a book on history on Hawaii. And I suppose because I'm British, I did find the British thread in Hawaiian history interesting, because of course the flag of Hawaii has the Union Jack on it. I think it's the only
Oh yeah, of course it does.
It's the only state flag in the United States that has a Union Jack. And that reflects the, you know, Cook, who was the first European to discover them, although maybe the Spanish got there first, not for sure. Polynesian adventurers had got there in 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. Cook arrives. Predictably, it all turns horrible. The introduction of European arms, the introduction of European diseases has its customary devastating effects. All the chiefs of the various islands start fighting one another. There's a great kind of series of battles and clashes. And in 1795, all the various islands of the Hawaiian archipelago get united under a king. And I'm going to apologies to any Hawaiian listeners if there are any out there. I know I'm going to mispronounce this, but he is called Kamehameha. And he is commemorated.
I'll take your word for it.
Kamehameha the Great. And he establishes a line of kings, all of whom take the name Kamehameha. So Kamehameha, the first, the second, the third, the fourth. And what happens over the 19th century is that Hawaii becomes increasingly part, kind of Anglo-Americanized. So there's both British and American influences. Yeah. And the intersection point of that is Protestant missionaries. So Hawaii becomes Protestantized very, very quickly. In 1840, it becomes officially a Christian monarchy. Protestant missionaries kind of end up becoming key players in the politics of this Hawaiian kingdom. So they kind of marry into the local aristocracy, they have children, they become advisors and so on. And this integrates the Hawaiian monarchy into the kind of the broader world of European and American geopolitics.
Yeah.
So you have this king called Kamehameha the Fourth.
I knew he'd be Kamehameha.
So he's a very, very, very traveled man. When he's very young, before he becomes king, he's crown prince. He travels to France. He meets Louis Napoleon. He goes to England and he meets, he doesn't meet Queen Victoria because she's, I think, pregnant at the time and is retired, but meets Prince Albert, meets Lord Palmerston, and then goes to America, meets the President Taylor.
Yep.
And then he's going back on the train across America. And he goes into his private compartment because, of course, he's a king, so he has a wonderful compartment. And the conductor, seeing that he's not white, assumes that he's a servant who's strayed in there and shouldn't be there, and upbraids him and tries to throw him off the train. And Kamehameha is obviously furious at this. And this is, I think, a sentiment calculated to make every Englishman proud. "This is the first time I have ever received such treatment, not in England or France or anywhere else. In England, an African can pay his fare and sit alongside Queen Victoria."
Oh, that's very heartwarming.
And you know the other heartwarming thing about Kamehameha?
He's a Wolves fan?
No, he's a big cricket fan. He's a huge cricket fan. So there's a kind of fascinating glimpse there of what Hawaii might have been.
A cricketing...
A cricket-playing part of the United Kingdom.
Guernsey.
Like Guernsey, exactly. Anyway, so what does this have to do with the 2nd of January? Well, it has to do with the birth of... The 2nd of January is the birth of King Kamehameha the Fourth's wife, Queen Emma.
His wife is born on the...
Yeah.
Okay.
So she's born on January the 2nd, 1836. Yeah. And her lineage is incredibly complicated, involving incredibly... Hawaiian names that
talk us through it.
So her full name is Emma Kalanikaumaka Amano Kaleleleonalani Nea Rook.
Oh, your Hawaiian is beautiful.
And the Rook is her stepfather.
Right.
So she's born to very distinguished Hawaiian aristocracy. There's then apparently it's the custom of the Hawaiian aristocracy that the children get adopted by step parents, and she gets adopted by an aunt of hers who doesn't have a child, who's a chieftain in Hawaii, and is married to somebody a missionary called Dr. Thomas C.B. Rook, and Dr. Thomas C.B. Rook is English. He came from Hertfordshire,
right?
studied at St. Bartholomew's Hospital, and ends up marrying into the Hawaiian royal family. And he builds what every visitor to Hawaii says is the most English house outside England.
Wow.
It's the most English-looking house.
I'm going to Google his house right now. What's his name? Thomas Rook.
Thomas Rook, with an E. And so Emma grows up in this incredibly English house. And she marries...
it's quite English. It's only quite English.
Well, that's its reputation.
Yeah.
Don't spoil it for people.
No. It's very English.
It's a very English house.
It looks like a house from Snow on the Wold.
Exactly.
But I'll say that to please you, Tom.
You know, and there are cricket nets for the king to practice his off breaks. And it's, you know, it's absolutely brilliant. She marries the king of Hawaii.
Yep.
And they have a son who they call Albert.
Oh, very good.
He was born in 1858. And do you know who Albert's godmother is?
Queen Victoria.
Yeah, Queen Victoria. Yep.
She agreed to do it?
Yeah, she did.
Oh, yeah. Good for Queen Victoria. That railroad conductor in the US wouldn't have agreed, but Queen Victoria agreed.
And unfortunately, the son, Albert, dies in 1862, and her husband dies the following year.
Yeah.
So she doesn't have a kind of official state. She kind of remains a queen, but she's no longer regnant.
Yeah.
So she devotes her life to philanthropy. So she founds a hospital to help Hawaiians fight smallpox. She sponsors education. She's a great enthusiast for opera. So she sings in the chorus of a performance of La Traviata.
Golly, that's very impressive.
She's also a very devout Anglican.
Yep.
So she gets the Church of England to set up the Church of Hawaii as a kind of branch of the Church of England. 1862, she gets baptized into the Anglican Church. And then 1865 to 6, she follows in her dead husband's footsteps by going on a grand tour of America and Europe. And she gets to meet Victoria.
Oh, this is a nice moment.
Yeah, and they get on tremendously well. Victoria is very, very fond of her. She meets Napoleon III. She winters on the French Riviera. And then she comes back to Hawaii. And in 1874, there's an election for the king because there's a kind of problem of, there's not an obvious candidate. And Emma runs as one of the two candidates. And so she's the pro-British candidate. And her rival is the pro-American candidate.
Oh, dear. I don't like the way this is going, Tom.
Okay. So Emma is the people's choice.
Of course. People's princess.
The people back Emma. They want her to be the queen. But the Legislative Assembly, who've been bought by the Yankee dollar, back her rival.
This is a poor story.
So this American rival, whose name is Kalakaua, becomes king.
What an absolute villain.
He becomes king. Well, he's not actually, he's not a villain. He's a decent man. And he leaves a seat for her at every royal occasion. So it's left for her.
It's easy to be magnanimous, though, when you bought the election.
You know, she keeps her title. She's known as the old queen.
She might not like that. Sound to me like he's a tremendous fellow at all. He seems like an absolute shit.
No, I think the old queen is a term of great affection and respect. And then she dies. But I think that's a kind of wonderful story.
So if she had won that election, do you think Hawaii would be British? Or it'd be like the Falkland Islands or something.
I think it'd be a constitutional monarchy.
Yeah, because what happened
The cricket-playing descendants of Queen Emma would be loyal members of the British Commonwealth, and it would all be tremendous.
You may not know the answer to this, Tom, but what happened to the Hawaiian monarchy?
British and American business interests, and chiefly American business interests, decided that the monarchy was getting in the way of what it wanted to do, of kind of... integrating it into the American economy, and so they toppled it.
Oh, that's very disappointing. So basically, toppled in the interests of capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Swept away by
well, I mean, classic Marxist.
Yeah,
strategy.
Sad. Very sad.
Feudalism toppled. Hard-nosed capitalists move in.
Okay, well, that cues up very nicely tomorrow's choices. Because tomorrow, I should be talking about a man who had a lot of time for monarchy. And very little time for hard-nosed commercialism. And that man, Tom, is J.R.R. Tolkien.
Brilliant.
Very exciting. So, We shall see you tomorrow. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.